I'm speaking with Nina Cummings, who for 30 years has worked on women's health, global health, and sexual violence prevention. And she is the sexual violence prevention coordinator at the Skorton Center for Health Initiatives at Cornell University's Cornell Health, which was formerly called Gannett Health Services. Cummings was a panel member in a PTA-sponsored event at Ithaca High School this past Wednesday called Consent is Not Enough, Engaging Our Community to Prevent Sexual and Dating Violence. Nina, thanks for talking with me today.
Glad to be here, Esther.
One of the items that you discussed on the panel was that students reporting incidences of non-consensual sex or touching occurs at about the same rate in high school as at colleges. The rate reported by seniors at Cornell in 2015 was 23%. What is the source of the data at Cornell and at high schools? And I'm wondering, how consistent is this data across the country?
Well, the data that we discussed at the high school event came primarily from a 2015 study that we did at Cornell. We hadn't actually looked at prevalence and incidence at our university in several years, many years. So we were glad to be able to collect more recent data, and that figure that you mentioned comes from that study. The law tells us, New York State law, that we have to do a study on our campus every other year. So, in fact, we will be doing, again, a study this spring. It will be interesting to compare the numbers 2 years later. In reference to the high school data, there are several scholarly articles out there that I looked at in preparation for the panel, and it again confirmed what we've always known, is that victims within the ages of about 16 to 24 are the highest risk group. That's always been known to those of us in the field. And when I looked at some of the more recent data, that again is confirmed. There was also some data that might be interesting that in terms of adolescence, sexual assault between the ages of 13 and 17 is relatively common, where about a third of those who responded to surveys in that age group reported some kind of non-consensual sexual activity.
And what are some of the factors that contribute to students committing sexual and dating violence?
Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of speculation. So obviously, students are, as adolescents, engaged in a lot of social events, interested in peer approval, exploring their sexuality and their sexual decision making. They are exploring their use of alcohol and other drugs, which of course makes people vulnerable. And then the backdrop, which is, I think, the more important piece of this, that creates attitudes that say it's okay to tell jokes, to demean individuals because of their gender, to try to take power over them. So we certainly have gender stereotypes, traditional gender roles that all feed into a climate that can create attitudes that allow sexual violence to occur. As I said at the event at the high school, these behaviors don't occur in a vacuum, that there has to be some kind of cultural examination as to why these attitudes are created, why they remain firm, and how they support what some others call a rape culture, a culture that allows this kind of behavior to occur.
And you mentioned at the panel that healthcare workers at Cornell have been studying this problem since 1988, and that the rate of sexual and dating violence hasn't really changed since that time. And I'm wondering, what do you think might be the reasons for that?
Some of the things that those of us in the field talk about is, while we have come a very long way in terms of attitudes and certainly in terms of resources for those who choose to speak out, to disclose their victimization, to seek support and help, we have many, many more resources now available for victims than we did back in the 1980s. But if you look at the attitudes, as I just mentioned, that feed this problem, really we are changing glacially slow. And that, I suspect, is why the numbers remain the same. Also, the risk factors remain the same. As I said earlier, things that feed vulnerability, assumptions about gender, about power and control, all of that really hasn't changed that much.
And let's talk about how the Skorton Center is working on decreasing the rates of sexual and dating violence. You talked about how there are federal and state mandates on consent education. Could you describe how consent education works and how Cornell is carrying out that mandate?
Sure. I mean, part of the reason that we did the program at the high school was to encourage discussions around consent, to start with young people who, as I said, are exploring their sexuality, are potentially engaging in intimate behavior, and why for a healthy relationship being sure that your partner is consenting to the activities is crucial, is important. But at the Skorton Center, one of the things that we've looked at, obviously, as we just mentioned, is how our numbers haven't changed. And we compare that to the fact that we have been doing consent education for 25 years. So what that tells us is while consent education is important, it is insufficient to prevent these crimes from occurring. So part of our mission and our charge is to look at best practices out there, is to look at the data out there, at the facts, and to consider how we might alternatively add to the consent education. As you said, we're mandated to do it, so here at Cornell, as with many other schools, and certainly schools in New York, our incoming students must attend an orientation program that talks about healthy relationships, that talks about the importance of getting consent, being sure the person you are with wants to do what you want to do, the role of alcohol in sexual decision-making, and a whole host of other sort of related factors. So certainly we expose our students to, you know, what we consider the basement, the basic facts around consent, sexual decision-making, and healthy relationships. But then we build on it, that rather than taking an individual approach to this problem, because, as you said, the incidence and prevalence didn't improve, didn't change, and go down. So we started considering what we now call a community approach, really taking what is a public health approach to these kinds of problems. And what I mean by that is taking a comprehensive, multifaceted approach to it. But looking at just something like sexual violence, we also continue consent education, but we build on that. And the community approach that we're now engaged in is making it everyone's business to pay attention, to recognize risk, to feel responsible for those peers, for their friends, for their classmates, and then to feel empowered to step in when they see something of potential risk. It's called a pro-social bystander approach. It's familiar to many of us who work on college campuses, but it counters the individual approach by making this everyone's responsibility.
I was looking at the Skorton Center website, and I noticed that there are a number of public health fellows at the center that utilize what are called near-peer student connections to deliver strategies to address sexual violence. What are the near-peer student connections, and what student populations are the public health fellows connecting with?
Yeah, so it's a terrific idea that someone came up with many years ago to hire students who have recently graduated. So students who graduated in May are recruited to work with us as full-time professionals, but to engage students in a more active way than those of us who are staff and, quite frankly, getting older and older, you know, in a way that young people can relate to. And the public health fellows are really our eyes and ears on the ground. So what they do is create opportunities for students to get involved, and then they organize and supervise those opportunities. Those are the near-peer connections. They are recently graduated students. They are now professionals and have to navigate that shift in their role from student to professional. But in fact, working with student groups, they respond better to our young professionals, and our young professionals professionals, it goes both ways. Both can guide and create some of these, as I said, public health options for students, engage students thinking more deeply about these issues and creating change within their communities. And then vice versa, our public health fellows hear from the students themselves and can bring back to us the ideas, what students are thinking, some of the more creative social media approaches, things that we might not in our staff bubbles actually understand or be aware of. So the work goes both ways, and it's been an incredibly effective way of both engaging students with these near-peer connections, but also bringing back and feeding our efforts in a way that will be both manageable and exciting for our students. It keeps us up on what students are thinking, feeling, hearing, how the attitudes are changing.
And how do the public health fellows reach out to student populations?
So I would say it goes both ways. Sometimes they are asked to come in. They do programs. They do presentations. Particularly, we have a very exciting new program called Intervene, where we created a video that demonstrates how this pro-social bystander approach can be applied to many different health topics, not just sexual violence, but also to alcohol poisoning and to dating violence and to bias-related incidents. So the public health fellows are now facilitating workshops and programs using this new video to engage students, but they also create groups on their own. So they reach out, for example, they have a wonderful Greek health and wellness group, which has representatives from our fraternity and sorority chapters on campus, so that an individual in each of the fraternity and sororities understands this public health approach and can bring information back to the students as a rep.
What is a general take-home message that you would say to our listeners who might have tweens or teens at home about how to prevent sexual violence? And is there a general take-home message?
I think the take-home message is, you know, for parents and being a parent myself, is to talk with your young people. First of all, find out what are they hearing, what are they seeing, how are they using social media as high school students, even as middle school students. So, you know, it's true of all of these health issues. Keep the conversation alive. Keep it open. Be yourself. Understand that as a parent, you may have a particular approach or attitude, and your student may not share that. But as long as we come at it from a non-judgmental approach, as long as we say, help me understand what you're thinking, tell me what you're hearing, and then I think being honest about how you feel as a parent about what the student is saying. If you find it offensive, if you disagree with it, I don't think there's any harm in letting your student know. And while they may argue with you, certainly, it is somehow being absorbed, and they are understanding that maybe what they're hearing among their peers may contradict, really, the values that they're learning at home. So reinforcing those values of respect for peers and openness to the fact that they are adolescents, they're learning, they're exploring. Also, I would say one of the more challenging things around reducing sexual violence is to help our young people understand that it is in their control. What we think might have more success is helping our young people think about the ideal. What is the ideal relationship for them? What is the best healthy relationship for them? So asking them those questions to focus on the positive rather than the negative might surprise our teens, that you're asking them to think about this ahead of time, but do it in a positive way rather than a negative way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nina Cummings, sexual violence prevention coordinator and victim advocate at the Scorton Center for Health Initiatives at Cornell Health, thanks very, very much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Esther.